www.radiomirchi.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. promises of support for a new Ramadi offensive. Texas police brace for more motorcycle gang violence.
I will tell you that in 34 years of law enforcement, this is the worst crime scene, the most violent crime scene that I have ever been involved in.
The 2016 race for the White House takes on a foreign focus. Horse racing fans eagerly await a possible Triple Crown winner. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. President Obama says there is strong U.S. support for Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi and for a new offensive by paramilitary forces to recapture the Iraqi city of Ramadi from Islamic State insurgents. Mr. Obama met with top security advisors Tuesday to discuss the situation in Iraq after the fall of Ramadi to the Islamic State militants. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says the attempt to reclaim the Anbar provincial capital became more challenging when Iraqi security forces abandoned a vast array of American military equipment while fleeing Ramadi in the face of Sunday's onslaught by the Islamic State fighters. VOA's Jeffrey Young asked Tony Cordesman, a top analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, why Iraqi forces do not seem able to cope with Islamic State advances.
The problems of the past government and something on the order of years of mistakes, failures, undermining the Iraqi forces, creating new divisions between Arab Sunni and Arab Shiites, unnecessary power struggles with the Kurds, factions that have paralyzed in many ways the actual political progress within the Iraqi Majlis, the Iraqi government, undermining the command structure, so in an effort to make it loyal to the prime minister. Inheriting Maliki's legacy is a nightmare for the current prime minister, who I think many people respect as being a better leader, better focused, and more successful. The other problem is that the army is an army which was shattered and had essentially disintegrated before the new prime minister took office. People tend to forget that when the U.S. military came back and became directly involved in the train and assist mission, there was a warning that this would take 2 to 3 years to change and reorganize.
At this point, what role, if any, should the U.S. play? Do we need to get back in there and get more directly involved, or is this really their fight and it's up to them to get their act together? Is there a balance in between? Where do you put this?
We made the decision not to send train and assist people forward. What we have done is try to recreate an effective Iraqi army from the rear. I think it is fair to argue that far too often this never works. One of the great keys to successful generation of forces is that we provide advisors forward, people who can help develop combat leaders at the battalion level, at the forward level, where combat actually is occurring.
In your estimation, what is it going to take to liberate Ramadi now from Daesh? Now that they have it, what does it take to take it back?
Well, the answer is none of us really know, because there's been absolutely no reporting on the size of the force that went in. What seems to be the case is this fairly small force, which used suicide attacks and effectively a well-managed attack, series of small attacks on the weakest links to panic the 8th Brigade, the reinforcements, and the police units. What it takes is finding a disciplined, at least brigade or two brigades of Iraqi forces, trying to see if there are elements in the popular militia that we can trust and that will actually work with Sunnis, trying to find some kind of Sunnis, at least elements, that will make it clear that this is not simply a Shiite advance. And then it means that the Iraqi government has to be ready, if not simply to drive Daesh out, but provide immediate incentives for people to come back and support them, and keep them secure. In other words, it isn't enough to simply win. To go back to a mantra of counterinsurgency, you have to be able to hold and build.
Tony Cordesman, a top analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The situation in Ramadi is a big story playing on social media. Here with a look at what our audience is saying is Michael Lippin.
Thanks, Ray. The U.S. position on the situation in Ramadi is one of the top stories on our website. It's dated May 19th, and it's titled, U.S. Supports Ramadi Offensive, but Concedes It Will Be Difficult. One U.S. reader from West Hollywood, California, named James Dyer, posted a comment saying he thinks the Shiite militias massing outside Ramadi are too uncoordinated and divided to do anything against ISIS, another name for the Islamic State group. He also says the solution to the Shia-Sunni crisis in the Middle East is to let the factions fight it out themselves. ISIS poses no threat to U.S. interests, except for American oil companies, and it's high time our government stopped throwing American lives and treasure away to protect the investments of those companies. And that's the view of our reader, James Dyer. As for how the Twitter universe is reacting to Ramadi's fall to the Islamic State group, the analytics website Topsy says Ramadi has been mentioned more than 36,000 times on Twitter in the past day. And one tweet that's generated dozens of retweets is from the Fox News TV network, quoting one of its contributors, former White House spokeswoman Dana Perino. Perino says she thinks the fall of Ramadi is arguably much worse than Mosul. Mosul is Iraq's second largest city, and it fell to the Islamic State in June last year. If you'd like to comment on any VOA story, go to the bottom of the article, look for the comments box, and we may read your post on the air. Ray?
Thank you, Michael. You can follow Michael on Twitter. His handle is at Michael_Lippin. That's L-I-P-I-N. Police in southwestern U.S. state of Texas say they're bracing for the possibility of more motorcycle gang violence in the wake of a deadly shootout between rival bikers and police that left 9 dead and about 20 wounded in a lunchtime shootout 2 days ago at a restaurant in Waco. Police say the gangs are engaged in a turf war for supremacy, and the fight is most likely not over. Law enforcement officials warn the biker violence poses a great threat to public safety. Here's VOA's Greg Flakus.
Police say the big shootout in Waco was a clash between members of a large Texas-based gang called the Bandidos and members of smaller gangs, one of which is called the Cossacks. Investigators recovered more than 100 guns on the scene and arrested about 170 people, according to Waco police spokesman Sergeant Patrick Swanton.
I will tell you that in 34 years of law enforcement, this is the worst crime scene, the most violent crime scene that I have ever been involved in.
Swanton says authorities knew the gangs were assembling in Waco and tracked their movements closely, having a unit on hand at the restaurant to take action if a fight broke out.
We were extremely fortunate to have our best, most well-trained officers here, and that was our tactical unit. They were here for the specific reason of we knew there was going to be trouble at this biker event.
Swanton says the gang members also fired at police, but no one other than gang members was wounded or killed. Federal and state authorities say the 2,000-member Bandidos gang is involved in drug smuggling and other types of organized crime. The gang formed in South Texas in the 1960s and now has affiliated chapters around the United States and in several other countries. Sociology professor James Quinn at the University of North Texas, who has studied biker gang group dynamics, says the character of gang chapters varies.
So you have a chapter with some guys that are fairly sophisticated and pretty into organized crime. You can have another chapter that is more on the misfit, just riding, drinking, carousing types. And sometimes you get a bit of both.
Quinn says men also join these gangs for various reasons.
A lot of them are looking for excitement and camaraderie. You've got other people that are looking for opportunities to launch organized crime.
Quinn and other experts on gangs say members are bound by an oath of loyalty to defend any member who is threatened by an outsider. The primary rivals of the Bandidos are members of the even larger California-based gang known as the Hells Angels. Both have international affiliates, and there have been violent clashes between them in Australia, Western Europe, and Canada, according to Julian Scher, a Canadian journalist who has written two books about the biker gangs.
More than 160 people were killed, most of them biker gang members, but some civilians. When the Bandidos and the Hells Angels fought it out in the streets of the province of Quebec, the Bandidos and the Hells Angels fought it out in Europe for control of the drug trade there. So the Bandidos have a long history of violence.
Scher says there may be a lull in violence following the Waco shooting, but he says eventually the gangs will clash again.
The image of the biker gangs really never changes. This is what they're about. This is their very nature. And it was just pure luck that there were no innocent people killed in that shootout, but there have been cases where innocent people have been killed.
Most of the people arrested in Waco are members of the Bandidos, and authorities there remain concerned that other members could come to town and clash with members of rival groups who are still in the city. Both Texas state investigators and federal agents are on the scene to assist in the investigation of the crime, and authorities say they have taken precautions to deal with any further disruption of the peace. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. The U.S. State Department is proposing the release of private emails from U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in early 2016. Mrs. Clinton's emails became the subject of controversy earlier this year when it was revealed that during her term as Secretary of State, which ran from 2009 to 2013, she conducted much of her communications over a private email account rather than using a State Department account. Meanwhile, on the campaign trail, national issues seem to be less of a priority so far, as my colleagues Susan Yockey and Jim Malone join us to explain.
Foreign policy issues are dominating the early stages of the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign. And national correspondent Jim Malone is here with a look at the issue. Welcome, Jim. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Susan.
Say, Americans often think of their own personal needs when it comes to the elections. You know, the economy, health care, that sort of thing. Why is foreign policy so important this time around?
It's the state of the world right now. Republicans are seizing on the unrest around the world, on some of the difficulties that President Obama is having with his foreign policy. And don't forget, the top Democratic contender is Hillary Clinton, who was Barack Obama's Secretary of State. So they're going to try to pin some of these foreign policy difficulties or failures, depending on your point of view, on her.
Well, do these candidates really have any experience with foreign policy? You think of them mostly as a national issue.
A lot of them are governors. Some do have experience. For example, take Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. He's going to announce soon that he's officially running. For all intents and purposes, he already is. He said the other day he's running now because the world is falling apart. Lindsey Graham is closely aligned with John McCain in the Senate, sort of a conservative voices advocating a stronger U.S. military presence around the world, ground troops if necessary in the Middle East to counter the Islamic State. So he's running specifically because of national security concerns.
Well, you mentioned Hillary Clinton. Does the importance of foreign policy right now, does this give her an edge up, an inside lane?
Well, the Democrats think it does. They don't think she can be attacked as inexperienced because of her tenure as Secretary of State. On the other hand, Republicans will seize what happened in Benghazi in 2012, the attacks there on the U.S. missions while she was Secretary of State. And they'll point to other problems with the Obama foreign policy. But, you know, I think for Hillary Clinton, her drive at the moment is trying to secure progressives in the Democratic Party. She doesn't want anybody on the left sneaking up on her. So her focus is making sure Democratic liberals are happy as they march toward the nomination.
Well, the economy is doing pretty good. Not great, but pretty good. Do you think this is going to be the front issue all the way through the voting?
It usually is. At the end of the day, it's how people feel about the economy, how they feel about where the country is headed. And even some Democratic pollsters, by the way, point out a lot of people aren't happy. They want some change. The trick for Hillary Clinton is going to be, I can be the agent of change even though I was part of the Obama administration. Republicans will have a different argument. They say after 8 years of President Obama, it's time for real change, and they're going to offer it. The interesting thing is, of course, on the Republican side, we don't know who's going to emerge as the nominee. It's going to be really fascinating to watch a large field battle one another for many, many months.
Yes. Now, news headlines on International Edition. President Obama Tuesday met his national security team, reaffirming strong U.S. support for Iraq's prime minister and a new offensive being prepared by paramilitary forces to recapture the city of Ramadi from Islamic State insurgents. In Burundi, more street demonstrations against President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid to seek a third term in next month's election. Protesters defying warnings to end weeks of demonstrations. Security forces used tear gas and beatings to clear the streets. At least 20 have died in 3 weeks of clashes. And the United Nations is intensifying pressure on Southeast Asian governments that have been reluctant to come to the rescue of refugees and migrants stranded at sea following a crackdown on human traffickers. Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand under international condemnation for turning away migrant boats involving thousands. I'm Victor Beatty.
This is VOA's International Edition, broadcasting from Washington. Still to come, a look at American horse racing's Triple Crown. But first, would you consider your country happy? This year's World Happiness Report came out last week with its ranking of 158 countries. If you missed it, fear no more. Here are some of the results, and they might surprise you, as Ramon Taylor explains.
Like some hit singles, Happiness transcends boundaries. But the reasons vary from country to country. The 2015 World Happiness Report, published by the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, uses experts in economics, psychology, health, and public policy to determine measurements of well-being across nations. In this year's report, Switzerland took the top honor, replacing Denmark, which finished third. Northern Europe continued to fare best overall, whereas the United States placed 15th, ahead of Brazil, but behind neighbor Mexico. According to Claire Bulger, editor and coordinator of the report, high income is a common variable at the top, but does not automatically translate to happiness.
Some basic level of income does matter. You need to be able to meet your basic needs, you need to be able to feed yourself, but after a certain threshold, income does not really matter for happiness.
Top-ranked countries also typically see low levels of corruption and strong social support. That is, having people you can count on in times of need. According to Bulger, social support is what largely differentiates Iceland, ranked second, and Greece, 102nd, in response to the financial crises that affected both. By comparison, the world's lowest-ranked countries, including much of sub-Saharan Africa, are often associated with extreme poverty, but not exclusively.
You now see Syria has dropped to the very bottom of the list. The Central African Republic is at the bottom, Afghanistan. So it's really countries that have had very, very, very poor countries and high levels of conflict and violence.
According to the report, other key variables that determine happiness include healthy life expectancy, freedom to make life choices, and generosity. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
Trending on the web, it's action, reaction.
Don't give me one.
Blues legend B.B. King dies at 89. Tributes from fans and celebrities coming in all over the internet. His legacy will never die, says one fan, and we agree. Bollywood superstar Salman Khan had his 5-year jail sentence suspended while he appeals a conviction for a deadly hit-and-run accident in 2002. Some are outraged, saying he shouldn't get special treatment just because he's a star. Khan's fans, though, are standing by him. We're not surprised by that. When I interviewed him in 2006, I could barely get near him.
Well, it's a lot of respect, it's a lot of love, and I'm fortunate to be in a position like this.
The Wells report says NFL Patriots quarterback Tom Brady was, quote-unquote, generally aware about the deflated footballs. Maybe he's generally aware that people out there think he's a cheater. For VOA's Action Reaction, I'm Lisa Vora.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Horse racing fans are again looking to see something that's not happened in 37 years, a Triple Crown winner. That is a horse that wins the Kentucky Derby, Preakness, and Belmont Stakes all in the same year. American Pharoah already won the first two earlier this month, the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness. USA Today's sports writer Christine Brennan talked with VOA's Jim Stevenson about American Pharoah, who had to overcome some serious weather issues last weekend to win the Preakness at the Pimlico Racetrack in Baltimore, Maryland.
Oh, I'll tell you, you know, it looked like the elements and the racing gods were against him. You know, the storm just showed up and just camped out right over Pimlico at the exact wrong moment. It's post time and the heavens have opened. It was just torrential rain and wind and lightning. And, you know, you're saying, okay, this is going to doom American Pharoah. You know, there's just no way. And of course, it was the complete opposite. This horse was unfazed by what was bothering all the human beings at the track and evacuating people and whatever. The horses went off and American Pharoah basically took the lead first moment he could. And never gave it up. And on the backstretch where there was a cluster of horses that were right there, and you kind of thought, okay, he's going to lose it here. And he put his foot on the gas and just went, wow, you know, boom. And seven-length victory in those kind of conditions and the mud and the slop, it was very impressive.
Well, there was only a short time, I guess, between the Kentucky Derby win and the Preakness, but now the horse will have about 3 weeks to rest and train ahead of Belmont. That would seem to give American Pharoah a pretty good shot at this.
It would. You know, the 3 weeks is another extra week. I was at the Derby. I was at the Preakness. And so let's hope that that's enough time for rest, you know, for the horse to get back into shape and be able to run the longest leg, of the course of the three legs of the Triple Crown, the Belmont Stakes. The problem, as we've seen over the past few years, California Chrome faced it last year, is all the horses who come in fresh. For example, Materiality and Carpe Diem are two of those top favorites from the Kentucky Derby who did not race at the Preakness. So they come in not with 3 weeks of rest and recuperation, but 5 weeks. And that is one of, I think, something that people have not really clued into until last year when the California Chrome, when the trainer, you know, went off on that afterwards and talked about how unfair it is that these horses basically cherry pick races, or the trainers, the owners cherry pick the races, and then fresh horses show up to beat a horse that has done everything that he had to do, which is be in both of those, the first two legs of the Triple Crown. So in some ways, to me, this strikes me as unfair. Experts in the sport will say, no, you don't want that. It could hurt horses. Okay, I understand that. We certainly don't want to be inhumane to any animal. But then what kind of competition is this when you've got a horse that, of course, like American Pharoah, now has to show up, obviously. It's the Triple Crown's on the line. This horse wins the Derby, so of course he shows up at the Preakness. And of course, then, after winning the Preakness, he shows up at the Belmont Stakes. And yet other horses can lie in wait and be totally rested. Is this really sport? It's certainly valid asking the question, and then asking the question, will we ever see another Triple Crown winner based on this system that now rewards those horses who wait and sit out a race and then come back strong and win the Belmont over the horse that has won the Derby and the Preakness?
Christine Brennan, thank you so much for joining us. USA Today national sports columnist, also with ABC News, CNN, PBS commentator. Who don't you appear with? Thank you.
Well, I'm glad, Jim, to be appearing with you. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Jim Stevenson. American Pharoah's race to possible immortality will be at the Belmont Stakes June 6th in New York. The cartoonist who drew Islam's Prophet Muhammad for the cover of the French satirical Charlie Hebdo magazine which was targeted for a mass shooting in January, says he's leaving the publication. Cartoonist Renaud Lussier, is known professionally as Luz, told the French newspaper Libération Tuesday that he can no longer handle the pressure of drawing for Charlie Hebdo because of stress and staff shortages. Lussier drew the illustration on the cover of the first issue of Charlie Hebdo after the shooting rampage at the magazine's Paris headquarters January 7th. Two Islamic radicals entered the building and began a shooting in an attack that took the lives of 12 people, including several cartoonists and other staff members. European Union and International Monetary Fund officials say they are making some progress in discussions with Greece to save the cash-strapped country from going broke. Greece's new left-wing government is struggling to come up with a list of reforms demanded by international creditors in order to obtain the final $8.1 billion installment of a $270 billion financial rescue package needed to avoid defaulting on debt payments due next month. Kiev lodged an official note of protest with Moscow Tuesday over two Russian servicemen it says its forces captured in eastern Ukraine. A Ukrainian foreign ministry official says that the presence of Russian soldiers inside Ukraine was a violation of all possible norms of international law and raised doubts about Russia's commitment to the ceasefire agreement reached between Ukraine's government and Russia-backed separatists in February. The two men were captured on Saturday and are now recovering from wounds in a Kiev hospital. And that's it for this edition of International Edition. Check us out for more news and information on the internet at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns in the strongest possible terms the murderous attack on a bus full of peaceful civilians in Karachi, Pakistan. Wednesday, May 13th was just another workday for many of the residents of Al-Azhar Gardens who rode on the pink commuter bus that morning. As the bus traveled its usual route, six men on three motorcycles pulled up alongside it and flagged it to a stop. The six men boarded the bus and immediately began to shoot the passengers. All victims were shot in the head, and at least 45 of them died. The Pakistani-based Jandala, a Tehrik-e-Taliban splinter group that pledged its allegiance to ISIL, claimed responsibility for the murders. The vast majority of the victims were members of the Ismaili community, a branch of Shia Muslims who follow the Aga Khan as their spiritual leader. The Ismailis believe that the Aga Khan has the authority to interpret the Quran in relation to the present time. They are peaceful, progressive, and non-political. According to Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, the Ismailis are a very patriotic and peaceful people who have always worked for the well-being of Pakistan. But to extremists, anyone whose religious precepts differ even slightly from their own qualifies as a heretic. Extremists see nothing wrong with killing a human being who does not worship exactly as they do. We offer our deepest condolences to the families of the victims. The American people stand in solidarity with the people of Pakistan and with the global Ismaili community on this tragic day. Make no mistake, said Secretary of State John Kerry. There is more strength by far in the respect and solidarity that we feel towards one another than there could ever be in any terrorist attack. The United States will support efforts to bring all those responsible to justice and stands ready to provide assistance to the investigation of this tragic attack.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.